Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, what the supply chain breakdown means for the region's ag industry. And later, a Fresno author recounts a heart-stopping race from Paris to Beijing and back in a single-engine Cessna. But first, megafires are becoming the new normal in California, every year destroying hundreds or even thousands of homes and putting lives at risk. But as KVPR's Carrie Klein reports, there's one glimmer of hope in the mountain community of Shaver Lake, where a piece of land that survived the Creek Fire shows the potential for slowing wildfires near communities.
About a mile north of Shaver Lake Village, in the Sierra northeast of Fresno, a left turn will take you into a community of historic homes on a wooded hillside.
If we hike up this way, we can get a bit of a view, or we can drive.
It's called Rockhaven, and Julianne Stewart tells me some of the cabins here date back to the original town of Shaver Lake, which was relocated and flooded when the river was dammed in 1927.
So most of these homes are about 100 years old. Many of them have been handed down through generations from the original owners.
Stewart doesn't live at Rockhaven. She's a forester at a consulting company. She's been managing the trees on this rugged property for years, and she's taken me to a dividing line on a hillside that became pivotal during the Creek Fire.
There's the green. There's the not so green.
To the left, charred husks of trees. No needles or leaves, the ground covered in ash. On the right, green trees that look, well, normal, except for some char on their trunks that stops about 10 feet off the ground. And the cabins, completely untouched.
That's nuts. I mean, that's like so stark.
It is. It's amazing.
The difference? Forest management. A few years ago, Stewart helped the residents get state funding to thin their dense stands of trees. But the funding covered only half of the 160-acre property. So when the Creek Fire roared through last fall, the untouched half was devastated. But the treated half slowed the blaze and suffered only minimal damage. Not only that, firefighters also use the property to help protect the rest of Shaver Lake. It's an example of how forest management can help mitigate the effects of catastrophic fire.
I'm so happy that these cabins are still here and that, I mean, as a forester, maybe even more importantly, that we have this much green, healthy forest still here that's going to be here for wildlife, doing everything that it needs to do ecologically.
Stewart's work at Rockhaven, which she refers to as treatments, involved removing dead trees and closely packed living ones, as well as the underbrush that could help a fire climb from the ground to the canopy. It's a far cry from just 5 years ago, when Stewart says the forest here was completely overgrown.
I think we could probably see close to 300 feet in some directions right now. Visibility probably would have been closer to 20 feet. Just incredibly thick.
Rockhaven was critical in the early days of the Creek Fire, according to Jim McDougald, who at that time was a local division chief with CAL FIRE. When the blaze thundered to Shaver Lake, it first hit land near Rockhaven that had also been treated, and it slowed. Then, because Rockhaven was in such good shape, firefighters could haul in a handful of engines and bulldozers. McDougald says for a day or so, they used it as a home base, using dozers and small burns to widen the highway and set up a protective border around Shaver Lake.
Having the ability to put that line around it and having those dead trees out of that community helped us do our job, helped us. It helped the whole community, of course.
The work at Rockhaven was funded through the California Forest Improvement Program, or CFIP, a cost-sharing program managed by CAL FIRE. Across 4 decades, CAL FIRE has awarded more than $75 million in CFIP grants to projects to make forests healthier and ready for wildfire. And McDougald says the Rockhaven project demonstrates the program's importance.
So this is a success story.
You bet. Very, very successful.
The treatments at Rockhaven didn't come cheap. Nearly $2,000 per acre. It's untenable at a forest scale. But McDougald argues it's feasible if forest managers target priority areas near communities.
Do you see that pink flag right there hanging? Mm-hmm.
That's looking out over the blackened half of Rock Haven, Julianne Stewart says it's hard not to feel a sense of personal loss.
It's a pretty huge disappointment to me because on any day of the week, I would much rather see a healthy, functioning forest that is providing all the goods and services that we count on it for. So it makes me really sad.
But she's also motivated to restore the forest in a healthy way. And with a new round of funding in hand, she's ready to plant thousands of seedlings to start a new forest of pines, cedars, firs, and giant sequoias. For KVPR, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. San Joaquin Valley farm workers and environmental justice advocates have been pushing for a system that will notify residents before pesticides are sprayed near their homes. A state agency says it's working on this type of system, but some residents say not quickly enough. KVPR's Mathi Bolaños has the story of one Tulare County woman's fight for health protections in her community.
Maria Alejandra Reyes worked as a farm worker for 15 years. She worked until she gave birth to her son, Daniel. When he was about 2 years old, she says she noticed he wasn't speaking or interacting like other kids his age. When she would take him to doctors in the area, she says they'd ask her about her exposure to pesticides.
You ask yourself, why is the doctor asking these questions?
A Spanish-speaking doctor later told her the questions were routine. Her son was eventually diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and a mild form of autism. She says she'll always wonder if her son's diagnosis was connected to pesticide exposure, especially as she learns more about the health impact of pesticide particles. A recent study from UCLA looked at the California Cancer Registry from 1998 to 2011. It found certain pesticides were linked to childhood cancer and tumors in children whose mothers lived within 2.5 miles of agricultural fields while pregnant. Julia Heck, the co-author of the UCLA study, says Latino families are mostly impacted by pesticides because they tend to live and work near fields.
So they may be exposed both residentially, but also maybe there's family members being exposed at work at the same time, and they're bringing that home. It's on their clothes.
Several years after Daniel's diagnosis, Reyes is still haunted by the doctor's questions. She connected with the Tulare County Coalition Advocating for Pesticide Safety, or CAPS, to learn more about the impact of pesticide exposure, and soon started sharing what she learned with her neighbors.
One? Oh, no, Dennis four.
It's a quiet morning in Reyes's home in Orosi, a small community in East Tulare County. Reyes and her four-year-old daughter, Zule, finish eating their breakfast of eggs and sausage. They plan to spend the rest of the day going door to door, handing out packets of information on pesticide exposure. As Reyes becomes an advocate, she's implemented changes in her own home. She says her husband, who still works in the fields, changes out of his work clothes before entering the house.
We have a table and a chair outside where he throws his clothes.
Angel Garcia, organizing director for the Tulare County chapter of CAPS, says residents like Reyes are becoming increasingly concerned about the health impacts associated with living, playing, and learning so close to fields where pesticides are sprayed.
Oftentimes they see people in hazmat suits spraying this stuff. And so their thinking is, if they're wearing protective gear to spray this stuff, what about us? What about our protective gear?
That's why residents and advocates are calling for the state to immediately implement the pesticide notification system. The State Department of Pesticide Regulation says it plans to launch the system by 2024. But Reyes says their health can't wait.
A rising star in the pesticide reform movement. She organized.
On a warm day in late October, Reyes speaks at a press conference outside the local office of the Department of Pesticide Regulation. In her speech, Reyes calls on the agency to ban the pesticides linked to childhood cancer in the UCLA report and immediately provide advanced warning of pesticide usage.
I live less than a mile away from the fields, but I don't have any idea what they're spraying, just that there is something in the air.
State officials say they are listening to these concerns. Earlier this month, the Department of Pesticide Regulation asked the public to provide input on the development of a pesticide notification system. But Acting Director Julie Henderson says it's a long process.
We're in the process of soliciting input on a variety of different elements of the system design, so we don't currently have a design of that system.
In the meantime, Rhea says there's no way to know when pesticides are sprayed outside their home. Their house faces a large stretch of grass, and just beyond it are grape vineyards. She says she and her husband often wake up to the smell of chemicals.
My husband gets up fast and closes all the windows, doors, everything, and we know that it will take a while before we can go outside in the morning.
Rhea says Orosi residents shouldn't have to live this way. She says she is fighting to ensure her community has the information they need to protect themselves. For KVPR News, I'm Maddie Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Rising inflation and the backlogs at our nation's ports are making it more difficult and expensive to buy some products. But this supply chain breakdown is hurting more than just consumers. To find out what this means for the region's ag industry, I checked in with some local farmers. From the Fresno County Farm Bureau, I spoke with Daniel Hartwig of Wolf Farming. Also joining the conversation from the Tulare County Farm Bureau were Matthew Watkins with Be Sweet Citrus and Landon Fernandez with Fernjoe Farms. Landon, I'll start with you. I've heard that the difficulty of exporting products overseas has become a big issue for the dairy industry. Is that something you're experiencing?
Absolutely. I've heard and read the same. I'm not as involved on the processing side of our milk. I manage the dairy cattle and dairy farms that produce the milk, and we ship our milk to a Land O'Lakes cooperative, where some of our milk is processed into butter and powder, in which the powder is a big export product. And I have heard and read about supply chain issues there. You know, China and other nations overseas are big buyers of a lot of dairy products here in the U.S., and there definitely has been a bottleneck, you know, that the processors, really not just here but across the country, have been experiencing and getting that product overseas. And you know, as far as domestic production, I think we're in domestic demand. I think we're seeing less issues here internally, but without a doubt, anything going to export has some hurdles to go through before everything clears up.
So, Matt, you're with Be Sweet Citrus. How are things going with your operations?
On the export side, you know, we just started our season for this year, so it's hard to get a feel yet how that effect may be. I know last year it had a huge effect in, you know, spring and early summer of 21 on the export, getting containers and getting them out of port to, you know, mostly Asia. And so far this year, we just started our export programs. Doesn't seem to be as backed up on that front, but we'll just have to see as it goes. We did run into a big issue during the summer, which was the imports, and the imports sitting in the water for an additional 2 to 3, 4 weeks really caused a breakdown on quality. And so that fruit got into the market was poor quality and, you know, led to lower prices and demand and a delay. And so a lot of that fruit delayed into the domestic season on the citrus side, which kind of affect the beginning of our normal citrus harvest because there was a lot of, you know, imports that were of poor quality still in the marketplace. And so now that's getting cleaned up. Ships are getting unloaded. And so we'll see how that export season goes for us.
Daniel, how about you?
Yeah, I'm an almond grower, and we've really seen a tremendous impact to pricing just because a lot of our almond product can't be exported due to, you know, a lot of the log jams and a lot of the, you know, the issues at, you know, the ports here in California, basically we've seen a huge drop in price, mostly because a good chunk of our product gets exported. So we've seen, just a tremendous impact to our pricing.
So we've been, I guess, talking mainly about exports, but we've come to realize, I think there's been a national awareness of just how complex the supply chain is, you know, everything from raw materials to labor shortages to equipment issues. Are any of you feeling pain points in other aspects of the supply chain?
Absolutely. This is Landon Fernandez with Fernjoe Farms. So just, to relate it back to my dairy operation here in Tulare, we've definitely seen an impact in our day-to-day operations because of this issue. There's a lot of specific medicines and antibiotics and vaccines that we use to care for and treat our cattle. And we've seen many products that we rely on heavily in short supply and in some cases not available. And we've had to look towards alternative products, keep up and, maintain the health of our herd and our daily practices. And, on the mechanical and equipment side, I've had a lot of issues finding various parts I need for broken down farm equipment. In fact, I have a John Deere tractor that's been at one of the John Deere dealerships here locally since August, waiting on a hydraulic pump that's still stuck in a ship somewhere off the port of Long Beach. So, I'd say that's really where I've seen the biggest impact. Obviously, prices for us are important, and getting our product to the necessary buyers through exports is very important. But as far as the day-to-day management and upkeep of maintaining our operation, I'm definitely experiencing that firsthand here on the farm in relation to the supply chain issues.
Matt, you're the director of farm operations at Be Sweet Citrus. Is any of what Landon's saying sound familiar?
Yes. Yeah. This last year's in all aspects of farming, we've seen issues in the supply chain getting parts for equipment and to just price increases. So, like irrigation, PVC pipe, hosing, anything like that, as prices skyrocketed. That's partially due with the fuel, but also just with a, kind of the economy jumping back up and going and there being a lack of supply of a lot of products because those companies shut down for a while during the pandemic. And the supply hasn't been able to catch up to the demand yet. Most recently, the biggest thing we've been seeing is kind of on the crop protection and pesticide area, where a lot of the kind of price regulation comes with a lot of the generics on the marketplace. And so those generics are, coming in as an import. And when some of that is slowed down, the domestic supply hasn't been able to keep up, and prices have skyrocketed on a lot of materials. And there's a lot of bulk raw materials we use, like copper and zinc for fungicides, that are basically can't be found right now. And so we're having to switch to some other fungicides for these fall sprays that are more pricey and may not do as well the job. So we've been working with all the chemical companies on trying to find out when the next load's going to come in, giving orders in advance, but there's no guarantee they'll have the products right now.
So Daniel Hartwig, as the president of the Fresno County Farm Bureau, can you sort of give us a higher level sense of what the overall impact of this combination of supply issues and inflation, what is that going to mean for the industry and for consumers as well?
Well, it kind of cuts both ways, right? I mean, so with the inflationary prices we're seeing, I mean, the consumer is seeing that, that bigger hit at the, in their pocketbook. I just saw this morning that the price of, Thanksgiving dinner, it's one of those things they send out every year, right, is the, this is the average price of Thanksgiving dinner, and it's up 16% this year, over compared to last year. So for the consumer, that's a pretty big impact. That's pretty significant. And on the flip side, at the growing side, our cost of UN32 compared to last year, one of the main fertilizers that a lot of folks use, is more than double. So, I mean, there's a significant impact to the consumer, but it's slight compared to what we're actually seeing on the growing side, what that actual impact is to our bottom line. our costs are skyrocketing, even faster than can be passed on even.
You know, Matt, you mentioned earlier that your season is just starting. How are things looking from a labor perspective? Is that a concern for you?
You know, so far this year, the labor looks to be in a little better shape than last year. Last year, we struggled with it mightily. There was a huge crop and, a smaller labor force due to the pandemic and government subsidies and different things, less people out there working, seems to have kind of got back to normal. There's a little more people available, but there's also a lighter crop this year, which is helping out quite a bit. So there's just less fruit, so less people are required to pick it. But we are 100%, hand harvested. And I would say probably during the fall and winter, right now, we feel confident on the labor force, but again, once we start competing against other crops next spring, there's always a shortage of labor during that time.
Well, Landon, maybe you could weigh in on what your future looks like. I mean, how significant has some of these challenges been in terms of your long-term prospects?
Very significant. I touched on a couple of things that are affecting our operation directly earlier. But to elaborate on that further and to kind of bounce off of some of the things that Matt mentioned, I mean, it's really just increased our overall cost to produce a gallon of milk significantly. I mean, from fuel cost to commodity cost to a lot of our feed cost, to speak on labor, we're not really experiencing any shortages, but our labor costs have gone up significantly as well. So, when I think about the future, I'm still very optimistic and I love what I do. And I think there's a place for what we do and a need for it. But I do worry about how we're going to, maintain profitability and survive in this industry when there's no end in sight to these increasing costs.
Matt, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm in agreement. We've been working on budgets for the last month, and it's hard to complete a budget this year with the uncertainty. Like Daniel said, with UN32 prices, with crop protection materials. Increased labor rates and reduction in overtime to the labor force starting at the beginning of the next year. And so we've been trying to keep at like a 10% increase on a budget year over year. And I mean, that's a huge increase that normally, we're trying to keep to 2 or 3%, And so, the biggest thing is can we sell our product for more to offset that? And right now we're having struggles working with the grocery stores and buyers out there to increase those costs. We have less fruit this year, so it should be cost a little more and get a little more for it. But, then you need a little more to offset the extra expenses to grow that crop. And right now, it's a battle every day to try to keep those up. And, we'll see how it goes. But like Landon said, it's not easy. It's something we want to be sustainable into the future. But right now, there's a lot of uncertainty out there.
Danielle Hartwig, I'll give you the last word as the Fresno County Farm Bureau president. Our region's economy is so reliant upon agriculture. Can you just sort of give your thoughts about what all of these added challenges to this industry are going to mean for the future?
That's a really big picture question. I could probably write a really long paper about like that if I had the time to sit down and do that. But
I'm sure you don't. But
as growers, we don't have that kind of time because we're always facing these day to day challenges. And as Matt alluded to as well, We're sitting there budgeting and hoping, and praying, as we're looking at budgets, we're looking at, hoping it's only a 10 to 15% increase, but we know it's going to be more than that. But we've got to try to, on paper, at least we've got to try to make this look like it's sustainable for next year and going forward. That's the struggle so many businesses and farmers are looking at is you're looking and trying to figure out what are you going to have next year? How much, can you make any money next year? Do I want to keep doing this? And go through the aggravation and the headaches and everything else that the state kind of puts on us here. You talked about the water situation being difficult. All these things are kind of stacked up against us. But I think, you know, farmers at the end of the day, we find a way to adapt and overcome. You know, we find a way to push our way through these struggles. But it's really tough. I mean, when the price, you know, when the price of your commodity doesn't match up with all these cost increases we're seeing, it does make it really tough. And it does make you sometimes sit down and think, how are we going to get through this? And I think from a values perspective, I mean, so much of what farmers and ranchers, what we produce, it just touches so many lives. Just, you know, every time we eat, you know, it's probably something that was produced, you know, some part of our meal was produced here in the valley. But beyond that, I mean, just the jobs and everything that, that we create, it trickles down to so many different industries here in the valley, you know, whether it's the truck dealers or you know, equipment dealers, things like that. We touch so many lives, and a lot of folks don't realize that. So when the ag economy starts to suffer, there's a huge impact, you know, throughout this valley and even throughout the state. So it's something that I think folks just need to be conscious of. And you know, we certainly aren't, you know, trying to create these, you know, shipping delays or shipping issues that are impacting us. And we certainly want to try to get those figured out as fast as we can.
I've been talking with Daniel Hardwick, president of Fresno County Farm Bureau, also with Wolf Farming, Matthew Watkins with B-Suite Citrus and the Tulare County Farm Bureau, and Landon Fernandez with Frencho Farms. Thank you all so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. When four teenage cousins from Madera learned their grandfather in Mexico was gravely ill, they journeyed back to their family's ancestral village in Oaxaca for the first time in their lives. But before leaving, they recorded video letters from their parents, who are farm workers that have been separated from their homeland for more than 15 years. The teens ultimately combined those video letters with footage from their trip to make the documentary First Time Home, which this month won the Rising Voices Award from the Portland Film Festival. I spoke with two of the co-directors, Esmeralda Ventura and Noemi Librado Sanchez. Sanchez started our conversation by describing her feelings about meeting her grandfather for the first time.
Well, at first, to be honest, I didn't really know how I was going to feel when I first, like, when I were to first see them and actually, like, meet them in person and stuff. Because, like, yeah, I've heard about them and I knew who they were and stuff like that. But at the same time, like, it kind of was like they were strangers in a way, but not really, because you knew that they were family. But when I did meet them, like, it was kind of like a hug to the heart in a way, feeling like you're there, like if we were there and part of our parents, you know. And like, just like, I remember getting to Mexico, like getting to the town where my grandparents were at, and my grandpa just hugging us and just being thankful that we got there safe and everything. And it was just like, finally being able to meet them was something like that you feel like it's like a movie or something. Two different worlds, because they're over here and we're over here, but we're like connected. And it's just seeing everything, that it's like living in a story, because that's pretty much what they were for a long time, you know. We just heard stories about the town and about my grandparents and about my uncles and stuff like that. But we never really knew how it looked or what it was. So when we got there, it was like we were living in the story that they were just telling us. Because it was exactly like they explained it. Like the roads were pretty dangerous. Like there's no hot water. You know, you're going to have to boil your own water. And just people wake up really early and stuff like that. So it's just, it was like experiencing what you were told for like the longest time and what you were hearing.
Totally. That's what it felt like watching it. Esmeralda, what was it like for you? I mean, what was it like to meet your grandfather for the first time?
It was a total new experience, honestly. Meeting him was like something special, because I went for me and part of my dad as well, because he hasn't seen them so long. And I know that from what I heard of was that my grandpa would always ask for my dad since he is one of his youngest. And it felt good seeing him. And I think him seeing me was like crazy to him to see like that he had like grown grandchildren. And yeah, it was a really nice experience.
I bet. You know, one of the parts of the film that I found so moving and so touching were the video letters that you recorded and were able to take both down to Oaxaca and back to California. It was, there was such intimacy and such vulnerability in those letters. And it made me think about what it must be like to take an experience that's so personal and share it publicly with the world. Now, I mean, this is an, you know, award-winning film now. Noemi, what is that like for you?
So those letters were really, it was like a way to connect and for everyone to see it. I really hope it just makes like some type of good impact in others and like makes a lot of people just open their eyes in a way, you know, that like people that are, that speak like some type of dialect or that are just like Mexican in general get like discriminated and stuff like that a lot. And people just think differently about us. And I just hope that like it makes them change their mind in a way. I mean, I know it won't change everybody's mind, but like Seth said, we're, the farm workers are like an important part of the society. And I just, even though it's like crazy that a lot of people are seeing something really personal, I feel like our story is very important, you know, and I just hope it catches someone's eye and just wants them to do something that can change for the better, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it certainly accomplishes that. Esmeralda, you know, I've done some video production work and I know how incredibly difficult and challenging it is. I'm wondering what advice you would have for somebody who might want to embark on a project similar to this. What advice would you have for somebody who might want to make a film about themselves or about their family?
I suggest for them to be themselves. And if they were to be recording, I say just act like as if like there's no cameras around so that people can see the full reality.
Noemi, I'm going to give you the last word. What do you hope people, and you touched on this a little bit already, but I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about what you hope people take away from this film?
Well, I'm going to use the example of people saying that we just come here to steal jobs and stuff like that, you know. For that, I want them to just like see that we really don't, like that is not what we come here to do, you know. And in school, I was actually learning about single stories, and that is like a single story, you know. Someone just says repeatedly, oh, this person that got arrested or in trouble or whatever is Mexican. So they just keep on saying it. And then just like make other people think that like, we just come here to like cause problems or something, you know, but that's not it. We come here for my parents, they came here for like something better. And one person doesn't picture the whole community or like the whole like race. Like, does that make sense? Like, just because one person does one thing doesn't mean everybody from the same place or whatever is the same. And I just want people to be able to see that we come here for something better and we struggle as well. And like, you don't see many Americans in the field, you know what I mean? Like, if Mexicans weren't to be doing all of that, then who would? Like, I don't really think, and then they don't do that because they want to. They do that because they need to, because it's a job that they found. to be able to survive and keep on going. And regardless of the circumstances, they keep on going. And regardless of how bad or how far the bathrooms are, or how small their lunch, or how like fast they eat their lunch because they want to get back on the field. Regardless of all of that, like, they're still here trying to just find something better. And all of that fruit that they pick goes onto someone else's table. Like, the fruit that is on your table might be a fruit that like one of our parents picked, you know what I mean? And like, I just really hope a lot of people are more open-minded when they see this.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I so appreciate and value your willingness and openness to tell your family story so that we can all see it. And it was such a pleasure to be able to see the film. And it was such a pleasure to be able to talk with all of you. So I've been talking with the team behind the documentary film, First Time Home, producer Seth Holmes and co-directors Noemi Librado Sanchez and Esmeralda Ventura. Thank you both so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. In 1987, Judy Lund Bell and her husband Jim left their Fresno home to embark on an adventure of a lifetime. Together, they competed in a historic air race from Paris to Beijing, battling headwinds and sandstorms in a single-engine Cessna. Now the couple is looking back on that journey in a new book called Flying with a Dragon on Our Tail. I spoke to Lund Bell about the race and the local hospital they raised money for along the way.
We ended up doing this to benefit Valley Children's. We took their stuffed giraffe, their mascot, with us in the airplane, and he turned out to be very, very popular.
I do want to ask you about the mascot later, because there's some great stories about that. But, you know, before we get there, I have to share with you that I grew up in Fresno, and I remember, I think I was in sixth grade when the race happened. And I remember hearing about you, you know, making history as the first female private pilot to land in China. And I just have to say, there was such a sense of pride in the community. Can you talk about how Fresno helped make this trip possible, and how you brought a little Fresno with you as you, you know, made your way hopscotching across the globe?
Oh, we did. Well, obviously taking the giraffe brought Fresno with us. And then we had our sponsors' names and logos on our airplanes. So we promoted Fresno wherever we were. And as a result of this flight, the next flight we did, which was in 92, the Round the World Air Race, the two stops in the United States were Fresno and Washington, D.C. So we brought that race to Fresno because we had publicized it and done this race. So we were always thinking about how we could publicize Fresno and Valley Children's Hospital around the world, everywhere we flew.
Maybe we could talk a little bit more about that giraffe and the royal impression that it made.
Oh, he did. We took pictures of him wherever he was. We have him on the Great Wall with the Chinese guards. We have him on a boat. I did an interview for French TV from a sandpan in Hong Kong Harbor, and he was sitting right with me, and the photographer made up a song for him. And then when we were in Amman, Jordan, King Hussein and Queen Noor threw a big party for us, you know, for the whole group, but not just for us, for the whole race. And their daughter was there, and she definitely wanted my giraffe. And I thought, oh my goodness, how am I going to do this? But her mother, Queen Noor, was very good and gave me the giraffe back. And then when I went to, I was called up by King Hussein for an award. Actually, he gave me a watch, and I took the giraffe with me, and he shook hands with King Hussein, and Queen Noor asked me about the giraffe, and so I told her what we were doing, and I gave her a copy of the little thing that we had sent out for donating to Valley Children's. So when we got home, all of a sudden, a check arrived at Valley Children's for $10,000 from King Hussein and Queen Noor. So that was pretty cool.
It's amazing. It's just wonderful. I don't want to give away anything, I don't want to give away too much from the book, but could you just briefly tell us a little bit about that really scary moment that you and Jim experienced on your way from Wuhan to Beijing?
Oh, yes. We had left Wuhan. It was that day we had flown from Dhaka, Bangladesh. We went to Kunming where we cleared customs. We stopped in Wuhan for fuel. And so it was very late at night. There was cloud cover above, and we thought it was going to storm, but the storms were a bit off to the east of us. And so we were flying through the dark. There's no lights on the ground because there's no electricity. They had no radar. They had nothing to guide us. We were flying through just on a watch and a compass in the very, very dark night. We had lights on our plane, but you could just see a little bit ahead and not very much. We weren't talking to anyone. We were out of radio contact with Wuhan and not yet in radio contact with Beijing. And our engine started missing. We had picked up some bad fuel in Wuhan and it had fouled our spark plugs. And so our engine was missing and we were flying through the dark and thinking, oh my God, if our engine stops, what do we do? You know, now you can, theoretically, if your engine stops, you can sort of glide down and land, but who knew what we were going to land on? Was it going to be into a mountain? Was it going to be into a lake? Were we going to take out a village? We had no idea. So we honestly thought that, you know, we knew we were in big trouble and we wondered if we'd make it. But anyway, we chugged on and obviously we did.
You visited corners of the world that most people will never see. And along the way, you recount stories of both extreme wealth and extreme poverty. And this is kind of a strange question, but it just made me think, how did those experiences shape your understanding of Fresno? You know, thinking back to, you know, former mayor Autry's, you know, described this as the tale of two cities. We obviously have so much poverty and so much wealth here in the Central Valley. What did you learn on this global adventure that maybe shaped the way you think about the community that you call home?
Well, we were in Abu Dhabi, which was one of the wealthiest places, still is. That's United Arab Emirates. We went from there to Dhaka, Bangladesh, which is one of the poor places, although they were a fairly new country at that time. And everyone there had hope. Even the people who were working on our planes, the people we talked to, they said, you know, we're really building, we're really doing something great here. And they did have parts of the city which were very modern. They had a beautiful railway station. They had some buildings in the downtown area, which were very modern. And then they had other places which were they were just mud holes. I mean, they were just horrible places with shacks. People were obviously very poor. They would ride around in carts either with a bicycle or with an oxen or a donkey pulling a cart. And they just seemed very, very poor. But there was a big divide between the modern part of the city and the poor part of the city. And we actually got to see both. And I did think about Fresno and I thought, you know, we have some issues here where we have parts of the city which are they're not mud holes, but some places I think are not a lot better. There was one in the newspaper this morning which was showing a neighborhood which had no streets, no curbs, no gutters, and the people were living in very, very dilapidated, very poor conditions. But, you know, the people who we saw there who were not wealthy, who were the poor people who were hauling us around in our little carts, either with a bicycle or with a mule, they would talk to us and they would be friendly and wonderful people. And they cared about what we were doing. They cared about their city. They were very proud that we had stopped in their city, that we had brought the race to their city. And they were very hopeful. They were very optimistic. And I thought that was a really nice. In fact, I liked Bangladesh better than I did India at the time. In India, there was also a big difference between the wealthy and the poor. You saw people camping out on the median of the boulevard. You saw people, a lot of people, you know, beggars and poor people living in very poor conditions. And, you know, it's the same thing there. And it might not be quite the difference here between the wealthy and the less wealthy, the poor, but there's still a difference. And that shouldn't be.
So there's more than a 30-year gap between the race and the publication of this book. In what ways did those years help you hone in on the themes that you wanted to explore in this book?
Well, I guess I didn't really think about the book too much. When we got back from the air race, Jim and I both had written about, 200-300 pages of notes. And I put them in a file and I put them in the drawer. And I kind of forgot about them. And then when I retired in April of 2000, we had always talked about writing a book someday. And I thought, well, I guess this is the time. So I pulled everything out and we put it together. Jim did a lot more of the technical stuff. And I did more of the people stuff, I guess. But I took his stuff and his notes and my notes, and I compiled them into one book, which obviously wasn't 300 pages, but tried to cull it down to what I thought was important and interesting.
Well, I so appreciate you compiling this adventure for us and preserving these great stories. I've been talking with Judy Lundbell, co-author of the book, Flying with a Dragon on Our Tail. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. By the way, if anyone wants to buy the book, they can buy it on Amazon, or you can go to the market at West and Herndon and pick up a copy there.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. KVPR is one of six public radio stations nationwide, chosen to partner this year with the Personal History Project StoryCorps on its One Small Step initiative. The idea is to bring together strangers with different political views to have personal conversations in an attempt to find common ground, or at least some shared humanity. In this segment, we hear from Wes, a 47-year-old philosophy professor, and Dinah, a 60-year-old healthcare professional. Both are based in Fresno. They find common ground when they talk about their experiences of being stereotyped. Wes as an evil atheist philosophy prof, and Dinah as a Black Puerto Rican who busts stereotypes and identifies as a conservative. Their conversation took place on StoryCorps' virtual platform, so you'll hear Dinah's dog making a guest appearance in the background.
How about you? Do you feel misunderstood?
Yes, I do. I don't know if you've always seen the memes and stuff of the atheist philosophy professor. There's movies about us. We're always the bad guys. I always feel like I have to be extra careful when students, especially because, you know, the Central Valley is a little more conservative area. I don't have that much of a vested interest in changing your mind. You know, I have a wife and kids and a new grandbaby, and that's what I want to focus my attention on, not making you good liberals or good atheists. I don't care about that.
Stereotype. Yeah.
Yeah.
Stereotype. Yeah.
You know, I do feel that way.
Yeah. I mean, read my bio. You could try to stereotype me right away. Uh-huh. Right. And we have a lot of that, unfortunately, in this country.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of stereotypes, you break the stereotypes, right?
Right.
And so I had to adjust my thinking around this kind of stereotype. And just thought, wow, I bet you feel really different as somebody who is a Black female professional who is a Republican. And I know that's just a weird kind of racial stereotype, but that was one of the first things that I thought of when I read the bio.
You know, I think all of my life I've had to correct people's thoughts of me. I was raised in Puerto Rico, so I spoke Spanish. When I spoke English, I spoke it with a heavy Spanish accent. And so when I moved to the States, because I came to the States when I was in high school, and of course, the other high school students are like, oh, wow, she's weird, right? Because I've had this Spanish accent and here's a Black person talking. So I had to deal with that. A lot of times, people, especially people of color, various colors, and I'm sure your wife has even been through this. You're portrayed one way, but if they get to know you a little bit, they'll find out, oh, this person, you know, it's not actually like that. You know, and that's part of the difficulty is breaking down those stereotypical barriers and really getting to know that person, you know, getting past that curtain. Well, I have appreciated talking with you very much. You know, too. Very much too. And if I see you on the street, I'll be able to say hi, Wes.
I would love for you to do that. And if I see you, I will do the same.
I may not recognize you without the pink headphones, though. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I wear these all the time, actually. Yeah, I'm never without these pink headphones. So you won't have to worry about that.
That was Wes and Dinah, One Small Step conversation partners in Fresno. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Mathi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.